souls, I want to thank you for being willing to come out and let me make my speech. I'm sure you knew that I was planning on it. You didn't want to disappoint me, knowing how well I like to speak. But I can say with all candor, this maybe was one of those trips that wasn't necessary, except that you've had a productive day, because you've had other meetings besides this, and you had the social hour, which I missed, which could have been a very productive moment for me as well. I've never forgotten what old Sam Rayburn used to say, there's no man's sense in a man feeling stupid and weak when for two drinks he can get smart and strong. And I could have used a little of that uplift. I could have used a little of that uplift earlier, a little earlier today. Dr. Glyer, it's a pleasure to be here with you, sir, and Dr. Cooper and others. Some of you have come up to say hello. I was going to give a couple of commercials, but I was told that was not ethically desirable and that it violated professional ethics, but I don't mind just tossing in a name here and there. But there are no customers here, that's the trouble. This is sort of like speaking. It's sort of like speaking to your own precinct caucus if you got it locked up. I've never had that happen, as some of you know around here, but it can happen. I asked, how do I pronounce all these names, these professional names? And ophthalmology I can get off with. I mean, I can say that one. But that one that is otolaryngology, or whatever it is, that's a little bit too much, but I found out that means ears, nose, and throat. So you ears, nose, and throat specialists, and you that are the specialist for the care of our eyes, let me just say, first of all, very sincerely, thank you. Thank you for your professional competence, and thank you very much for doing what you are doing and have done to lift the standards of professional medical care here in Minnesota and throughout the country. I'm very proud, you know, of our state, not only for its many resources, natural resources, but particularly its educational institutions, its quality of education, and for its medical care. Just yesterday, I was meeting with some of our friends from the Mayo Foundation, and I'm very much interested in what we're doing in our great university medical school, what we're doing in all the healing arts, and what we're doing in throughout the private profession in this state. There are very few states, and in fact, there are very few areas in the world that has a quality of medical care as we have here in Minnesota. And I think we take it for granted. We don't really toot our horn. I'd like to give you about a pint of Texas blood, each of you, to kind of, you know, to brag about it a little bit, because we really have something going for us here. And the message is getting around, obviously, because people come from far and wide to receive the quality of care that is available here. Now, excuse me, I want to compliment Dr. Cooper and all of those who've made your program possible, not that because I got invited here, but because your program is much broader than just this talk this evening. I understand that after a couple of taxing years as program chairman, he'll be able to relax as president of your academy. You know, I was a program chairman once, and I now know what it means to get a speaker. I used to think, you know, it was an honor to be invited until I was a program chairman. You'd take anybody if you can get, you know, you can get him to come. But Dr. Cooper, I want to wish you well. I'd just like to get elected president of something sometime in my life. I read over the biographical material relating to Dr. William Benedict. I know this is termed as Dr. William Benedict lecture, and I don't want to make it quite so formal, even though talking to you as specialist, I'm somewhat terrified, ordinarily not. You want to talk economics, I feel perfectly capable to do that, because that's not an exact science. I hope there are no economists here. If you want to talk politics, I can talk that. That's what we were talking about earlier, chaos, confusion. We can talk that. But I have to, and I'm not going to try to talk to you about your profession as such. I don't lay claim to that. I am a sort of a shirt-tailed pharmacist, and I always mention that, and I also have been a teacher. I mention that because my profession is uncertain. And you might want to keep me in mind in case that any of you are looking at clinics where you need a pharmacist, or any of you that have contacts with school boards or the Board of Regents where they may need a teacher. I used to joke about this, but it came true, you know. I had to look for a job after a while, so I keep it up. Well, in a memorial tribute to Dr. William Benedict, I think it's most appropriate that we emphasize here what we call the quality of health care. For Dr. Benedict served nearly for three decades as the executive secretary of this academy, of the total national American Academy. And he was also, as you know well, long associated with the Mayo Clinic and as with our university medical school and as a professor. And he helped make the clinic one of the outstanding medical centers in the world, and that it is. Such people as Dr. Benedict have ensured that Minnesota, which we pride ourselves in calling the North Star State or a pioneer state in so many areas, also is recognized as an innovator in medical treatment and teaching. The HMOs, for example, started here. Dr. Elwood, I believe, has had a great deal to do with that. We've had many innovations in this state. We've done a great deal in group practice in this state. And there has been, I don't know all of the innovations, but whenever you're talking with medical people, for example, in cardiac surgery and in heart care, and this state has been an outstanding example of pioneering. And I take great pride in this as a representative, as a public spokesman for Minnesota and the consuls of the Congress and throughout the country. But if we as a nation are going to meet the goal of the Mayo institutions to provide quality and comprehensive health care to all, rich or poor, black or white, urban or rural, at prices that they can afford to pay, I think there has to be what we're doing here tonight. There has to be a dialogue, not a shouting match, but a dialogue between elected officials and the providers of health care. Let me quickly say this. I don't want to have health care problems just decided by people like myself. But if you don't help decide it, that's who's going to decide it, you see. So we have to work together. And the important thing here is to get this dialogue going and amongst people, hopefully, who are reasonable and intelligent, but people who may have strong feelings about their particular point of view. But to recognize that there are changes in the social fabric of our country, just as there are changes in your profession. And every one of you are trying to keep up to those changes. One doesn't need to be an ophthalmologist to see clearly that some form of national health insurance will soon be a reality. I can remember when years ago I introduced some legislation in Congress in 1950 for national health insurance. My goodness, I sent that bill out around this state to get the point of view of people. I just was pioneering. I thought, well, let's take a look at it. I learned early, and I surely have learned again and again, that in Congress, if you introduce a bill and it comes out with your name on it, much less any of the substance of it, that you consider it a major victory. But we do this, let me just say to you so that you'll understand, many times we do introduce legislation merely as a point of reference, a point to get started. You've got to have something around which to focus. It's a predicate, as we would say, a frame of reference, a point of reference. And that doesn't mean that the legislative proposal that you introduce is exactly what you will want after you've listened to the testimony. But it is what you believe is a concept, an idea, and then you try to get people to reason around it and to think about it and to come up with some constructive suggestions. I am a legislator, and I modestly tell you that I think I've had a fairly good record in being creative in legislation, because I'm willing to try, to venture, knowing full well that you run some risks. But I don't care particularly for a very comfortable existence. If I did, I might choose a different way of life and a different lifestyle. I kind of like the excitement that comes with the challenge that is to be found in change and in controversy and in the vigor of argument. Well, during evenings like this, I think we can develop. Could you give me that water over there? We've been combating a little flu in our family, except for me so far. Prognosis doesn't look good tonight. During evenings like this, we can develop a basis of understanding, and I think begin to lay a solid foundation for improvements in our healthcare system that every citizen today demands. And let me emphasize this. I know a little bit about what the concerns are with people, and that's my job. And and I don't always have to look at the Gallup poll. All you need to do is just go around and bump shoulders, and I get around. I have to do that. I'm not one that gets myself off in the corner and just meditates. I think it might be better sometimes if I did more of it. But I try to sense what people are thinking and what their needs are, or what they think their needs are. And one need that they seem to have today is the need of a better system of health, not so much of the health care, but a better system of obtaining the superb care that is here. Now, let me make it clear quickly. People from all over the world come to the United States for health care. That ought to tell us something. It tells us we got the best medicine in the world. And we have. Do we make any difference whether it's Brezhnev or King Faisal, or the Emperor of Japan, or the Prime Minister of India? I'll guarantee you, if they had an illness that necessitated certain particular disciplines and certain particular specialties, they'd come to the United States of America. 100 years ago, yea, 50 years ago, that was not the case. But I have traveled in many countries, and one of the things I've noticed as I've gone into medical offices is to note that the literature today is not as it was 75 years ago, 50 years ago in German, or even in French, it's in English. And most of the medical literature that you see carries the imprint of some very famous or respected American physician or researcher or somebody from some of our great laboratories. But despite the great strides that have been made through the efforts of dedicated health professionals like yourselves in the prevention and in the treatment of illness, injury, and disability, and despite the fact that many Americans, as I've said, receive superb and excellent health care, far too many of our people remain outside in the periphery of our nation's health care system. And I can hear what some of you might be thinking, well, if they really needed it and wanted it, they could get it. And I know that many times some of us feel that way about many things, but there's a great deal of difference between that and having it readily available without all the fussing that we have to go through sometimes under the programs of charity and welfare that are called health care. For too many millions of Americans, our health delivery and financing systems are a failure. I'm going to give you plain talk. The country spends spent over $90 billion this past year on health care. It's running about a $90 billion figure for a minority. The care is superb, as I've said, the best of the world. For the majority, sometimes it's adequate, and for many others, it is non-existent, deficient, or badly distributed, and not available. It's incredible that in the United States, the richest nation in the world, still, despite our problems, both in natural and financial and human resources, that we rank far below, and you know all those figures, I'm not going to burden you with many of the other industrialized nations. Now, by the way, I've got to say quite candidly that I think our statistics are a little bit more accurate than they are in some countries. And we may be a little more exacting, but the truth is, regardless of how you interpret the statistics, whatever ranking place that you put us, that we are not very good when it comes to infant mortality. I want to speak about the national scene here, because we can't all live in Minnesota. I think we do fairly well in Minnesota. We're not particularly good in maternal mortality, nor in male life expectancy. In 1973, for example, we were told of a critical shortage of some 50,000 doctors. Now again, figures are always subject to dispute, and I try to be a reasonable man about this. We maybe don't need that many new doctors. Maybe it's a question of how we use our trained medical personnel and try to use people that are not in the professional category as such to do many of the things that doctors do that they ought not to do. I still think that a good pharmacist could do a urinalysis, and that I still think a good trained nurse can do much of what sometimes doctors in some parts of America, and don't judge everything by your own situation here, are called upon to do. We're learning a great deal about the use of paramedics and of what we call medical technicians. But it's still true that we're desperately short of nurses, and that we could use 100,000 to 150,000 or more medical technicians In fact, if we had national health insurance of any degree tomorrow or next month, we'd have, I think, medical chaos, because we're not equipped to take care of what would be the unbelievable inflow of patients coming into our outpatient departments, into our hospitals, and into our clinics with the advent of a major total national health coverage insurance system, what, regardless of what kind it is, whether it's a government one or whether it's worked through the private insurance companies or whatever it is. And all of the witnesses and all of the testimony from the American Medical Association on down recognize this. And so that what we are now in the process of having to do is to build up the so-called infrastructure and the medical personnel that is necessary, or better to put it, the healing arts personnel that's necessary for a major revision and improvement of our system. Now, you may take issue, for example, with this statistic, but it's accurate, that more than 1,600 counties in the United States, having a total population of over 23 million people, do not have one single active resident pediatrician. Now, why is that? That's maldistribution of personnel. This is one of the great problems we have. And understandably, I mean, why would somebody want to be some of these places? You understand that, but there's still people there. And we have a problem. And therefore, now we're working, as you know, with the so-called programs of financial assistance for the training of medical personnel, which is a very expensive training, of how can we have recruit people to go into the rural areas. And it's true even in Minnesota. It's not just true, you know, I live in a little community called Waverly. And thank goodness we have a doctor that comes over from Cocato that helps in our little clinic that we have out there, a clinic that's helped sponsored in part by OEO funds and state funds. It's been a godsend. I hope that many of you in this audience are aware of the fact that in our rural areas we have unbelievable problems for the teeth. I don't know what the professional, but we need dental care, and we need it desperately. And it's one of the great medical problems in this country. And we constantly are talking about surgery and general practitioners and the specialists, but with the amount of dental care that's needed in this country is something to be alarmed about. Far too many of our counties do not have any primary health care provider at all. The serious maldistribution of personnel intensifies the effects of the absolute shortage. Unbelievable as it may seem, many central city, ghetto areas, and rural areas in the United States have fewer doctors per person, that is per 1,000 people, than many Latin American countries. And some doctor population ratios approximate those in India and Bangladesh. Now that's from the census. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of doctors, because you can go to Philadelphia or Boston or New York or Detroit, and you can find them just by the, you know, there are so many that you kind of wonder what they can all do. But the problem is in some of the highly congested areas of people of low income, and yet these people have to be cared for. Health programs and organizations are frequently fragmented. And then we see that, as I've indicated here, that highly professional manpower is sometimes poorly distributed. Many facilities and services are either unnecessarily duplicated or tragically neglected. For example, I had a study made some years ago in New York City of cardiac treatment centers. And those are very costly. And I found that in some of them there had been as few as 6 patients in the entire year. But they want the whole set of equipment, rather than being able to pool it, so to speak, and having centers where you can come to. Now, we're looking at this. I just met today with a doctor from the university in radiology. And radiology is a very costly treatment. The question is, how many centers can you have for the modern type of equipment that is needed for the radiology or radiology therapy, whatever you call it? How many cobalt systems can you have? How many deep x-ray systems can you have? How many scanners can you have? How much of all of this? I'm only thinking out loud as a layman. Now, in the last decade, the American people have watched healthcare costs escalate about one-third faster than consumer costs in general. There are reasons for it, and it isn't something that we should scold somebody about. It's something that we have to look at and face up to. Now, these are the facts, and they are frankly unacceptable. You know it, and I know it, and I think most of the people know it. And therefore, they take these problems to those of us in public life and others. And I think it's fair to say that we cannot, nor will we will not, continue to accept the rationalization of this situation as being inevitable, if unfortunate, as a byproduct of what we call the free enterprise medical or health system. You're no doubt aware that some of the recent congressional attempts to hopefully upgrade the quality of health care, and the best that it can do is set standards and provide funds for assistance. There aren't very many doctors in the Congress of the United States or very many health professionals. We passed a comprehensive health planning measure to help develop a national health policy and effective state health programs. Planning is necessary. And one of the problems at the state level is the lack frequently of planning funds. So here's where the Congress stepped in to try to be of help. Now again, this wasn't something that was a wild-eyed idea of somebody down there didn't have anything else to do. This came from public health officers throughout the United States who came to the Congress and said, we need your help. This came from governors and legislators. It came from state medical societies who asked for the help of the Congress. We passed, regrettably the president vetoed, a health services and revenue sharing bill, which would have provided federal assistance to state public health services for migrant health programs and community health centers, and family planning programs. The reason for the veto was essentially because it seemed to be too extravagant in the eyes of the Office of Management and Budget and the president. I have to be very candid with you again. I don't look upon these matters as expenditures. I look upon them as investments. You know, we're all very human. We generally take care of our health after we've had a major catastrophe. We go on out here, and I'll venture to say that most of you are as guilty of it as I am. And until you've had a little trouble, you don't go see your doctor as often as you could. You don't get your checkup, and your family, despite the fact that your professionals doesn't get the checkups that it should have. We're not much on health insurance. We're much more on sickness insurance. You got to get sick first. And preventive health care is and has not been one of the major programs of this country, publicly or privately. Now, we've had differences in the Congress over health manpower programs. And by the way, I visited with a number of our people in Minnesota, at Mayo's and the university and elsewhere, about what kind of health manpower programs we should have. And we'll have to resolve those differences in the coming session. We passed a compromise bill that didn't go too far, but there are very serious problems in health manpower. Now, we must initiate, because I think there are things that we ought to do long before or before we even get into this matter of comprehensive health insurance. We need to initiate a new child and maternal health care policy for the United States. Absolutely essential. I propose some legislation, which would be a focal point, to assure that all infants, children, and pregnant women, without regard to their place of residence or family income, can have equal access to medical diagnosis, screening, and comprehensive medical care. We've got Medicare for grandpa and grandma. We get it when we're old and ready to die. Why don't we get it when we're young and ready to live? I am going to be quite dogmatic. Many of the afflictions which affect us in our older years are correctable in early care. We know that. And furthermore, we have one wonderful place to get to the children called schools. It's a natural place, and we ought to be doing much better. Our school system needs to be looked at very much so. I must say I have a constant argument with some of my intellectual friends. I still think it's proper to teach nutrition in school, you know. I think it's proper to teach physical education and physical fitness in school. What good does it do to be able to read Chaucer and Shakespeare if you're sick? We need to have people that are healthy, and healthy bodies help promote healthy minds, and healthy minds, healthy bodies. This is where we need the care. We need that care at the time prenatal and postnatal and maybe the first 12 years of a child's life. Those are the formative years. And I gather that men and women in this room that are in the treatment of the problems and the disease of the eye and the disabilities of the eye or the ear or the nose or the throat know this almost better than anybody. Because we can make corrective surgery. We can make correction for disabilities early. But try to do it after a fellow's 50 or 55. First of all, you're wasting a lot of time on him after that anyway. He's got much to go. I got to philosophize with you, just like I told my kids. I said, now look, when you're young, I want you to buy a house that you can't afford. Don't be like your dad. I'm the damnedest fool that ever lived. Because when you kids were growing up, I was afraid to get in debt, and I didn't want to have a good house because it cost too much, and we had less than we ought to have. And now when I'm old, I got two houses, don't have time to live in either one. The time to have a home is when you're young, when your kids are growing up, and that's when your earning capacity is good, and if it isn't, you can get out and do twice as much as you thought you could do anyway. And the time to take care of your health is when you start. And you doctors ought to tell people this every day of your life. And don't worry so much about grandpa and grandma. Important as it is, I'm the daddy of medical care. It's one of the first bills that I introduced and got passed. I believe in, honor thy father and thy mother and love and take care of thy grandpa and thy grandma, since I'm a grandpa. I'm all for that too. But I also know about grandchildren, and I know about children, and I know that they can be helped. And I want to say again that if we give them proper health care, proper nutrition, preventive health care, we'll have less drug addiction, we'll have less problems all the way down the line. There are statistical studies that go by the dozens that prove my point, but I'll be damned if anybody wants to pay attention to facts these days. We prefer to live by our prejudices. We know that we can cut drug addiction with proper nutrition. Now, we know that. That's been scientifically demonstrated. But we still would prefer to spend millions on treating addicts rather than spending a few million dollars on teaching proper nutrition in the schools of America. And the best nutrition we get now is from Kellogg's. They got that, that fox and that bear or something, that, anyway, those crispy things that they've got, and they do teach a little nutrition. So here, I guess what I'm trying to say to you is preventive care. And we need to develop to a comprehensive, humane, and cost-effective system for the health care needs of the chronically ill or the disabled persons. I think we need to strengthen not only our cancer research, which is terribly important. You know what we're doing? Because cancer is such a critical, such a terrible disease, because it has such a, there's such fear about it in the mind of the public, that the Congress of the United States now and the executive branch have put the emphasis upon cancer and heart disease at the expense of many others along the line. My neighbor is a wonderful friend of mine, is crippled with rheumatic arthritis, or what do you call rheumatoid arthritis. My God, what a misery. And when I think of the many other things that need our care and need our attention, and when I think of how foolish it is to break up these teams that we bring together in this research. It takes years sometimes to bring a team of researchers together. And then we got all kinds of restrictions on how much you're going to pay them, particularly if they're in the government. Why? And it's so ridiculous. Because once these teams are destroyed, or once they have to be disassembled, so to speak, because of lack of appropriations, it takes, you've lost the momentum, and you've lost possibly years of scientific achievement. So we should include effective systems for the rapid dissemination of information on new developments in biomedical research so they can be applied to medical treatment. You know that the National Medical Library was charged in Washington years ago with setting up regional medical libraries all over this nation, a system of immediate printout so that wherever you are as a doctor, you can just punch the button and bang, out comes the latest information. Information retrieval is a science all unto itself. And to show you the timidity, I went out to the National Medical Library because I was one of the authors of the bill, and I found out they didn't even have the guts to ask for the money. I said, my God, what are you doing in government? We all know how to ask for money. They were getting the same budget in 1973 that they got in 1965. And they were calling it doing their job. And I said, what happened to the use of the computer? Are we still going around with smoke signals around here? What, do you have to write it all out in cards? Let's get going. Now, I want to tell you, dear friends, I served in the National Security Council, and while I was there, in 4 years, we changed the computer system of the Department of Defense three times. Three new levels of computer, they call them three new generations. Off at Air Force Base, down here, the big center for our Strategic Air Command. The whole computer service in the Offutt Air Force Base is more than the total medical research program for cancer. And nobody thinks a dime about it. I mean, you go, I'm through like a dose of salts in Congress. Because somebody down there, those generals, know how to ask for it. They ask for more than anybody's bound to give them, and they know that, and then they get more than they ought to get. But our doctor friends are always worried a little bit that government's going to get their hands on you. When it's going anyway, you better start helping shaping it, friends. You're just looking, you're like old King Canute standing up against the tide. It's coming. The question is, do you want it to come your way, or do you want it to come some way of somebody that's decided that he's going back to bleed people and put a barber pole out in front as the sign of his medical competence? I guess that's straight talk. And I want to talk straightly. I want nothing from you. There's nothing you can give me. There's only one thing I'm interested in, is getting your interest in designing a program that you can live with, that's good for patients and good for the country. And I don't think that some of us who are doing some of the talking about it all the time quite know all that. We need your counsel. We don't need your obstreperous resistance. The AMA for years just leaned back, you know, Dr. Morris Fishbein, a brilliant man to be sure, one of the cleverest lobbyists that ever came to Washington, get nothing done. He's gone. Now the AMA is different. There's a whole new breed of doctors. And today they're not buying everything that some politician dishes up, but they're coming up with counter proposals. And that's what it's all about. So I think we have to address that silent crisis of incredible proportions in this country, which I've talked about, which is called malnutrition. That's really one of the big problems in this country today. I wish we had as much attention being given to malnutrition now on the ads as we're getting to alcoholism. Both are necessary, or drug addiction. But again, malnutrition is something we can do something about promptly. We've got the food, you know. Our problem in America is not that we're wasting away, it's obesity. It's how do we get rid of what the extra that we've eaten. But the problem is, we do not have real understanding of health food. Only recently we began to recognize the widespread incidence of serious illness and disabilities that can be directly attributed to poor diets and bad eating habits. And we must look more to preventive health care, keeping people well. What is it they used to say about those old Chinese doctors? They only paid them when the patient was well. When they were sick, you didn't get paid. Well, I don't know about all that. I was over there in China. By the way, I saw their medicine. They have Western medicine. Of course, I didn't learn too much because it was only a 14-day trip. But I visited several hospitals and had a chance to talk with some of their medical personnel. Some of them, by the way, as you know, were trained right here in the United States. Some of their top people are from Johns Hopkins. Some of them are from Boston General. They have good medical people. They have the mixture of both the Eastern of their Chinese medicine, their traditional medicine, and Western medicine, with some acupuncture tossed on in. They do quite well. Interesting thing is that China has done two things, dear friends, that are basic to any society. They provided for food and for health care. They have over a million what they call barefoot doctors, and they're trained. These are medical paramedics. And the doctors from the top hospitals, for example, the top children's hospital in Peking, it's a good hospital, top medical staff. Our people told us, medical people said they're good. They're professionally good. Those doctors are taken out into the countryside. They don't bring the folks on in there. They take the doctors, the whole team out into the countryside twice a year to upgrade kind of a continuing education for the barefoot doctors. And this goes on all the way through. They get primary medical care, elementary medical care. Well, now, I'm not going to try to give you, again, my prejudices, but my dad took care of more patients than most doctors did when he was just a pharmacist. Most people come on in, they got a headache, they got a bellyache, they got a backache, and maybe they had a fight with their wife or their... I always found out that in depression, the incidence of constipation was much larger than it is in prosperity. I know that sounds almost earthy, but it's true. I remember back in the Depression days, all we could sell was Crusian salt, sal hepatica, and what we called 10-10-10, you know, that bismuth, manganese, and calcium tablets or something. I mean, sodium bicarbonate and all those great big 10, those 30 grain pills that we used to get a hold of. And people all had acid stomach. After they got prosperity, that wasn't their problem at all. As soon as their prices got good and their wages got good, they got over an awful lot of their ailments. A lot of it's psychosomatic. And as we know, this is why where a lot of our professional medical care is used its talent without being necessary. Well, now, quite quickly, and I'm going to close off here. The big problem today for most people is, of course, in catastrophic illness. We've got to approach this problem. What are we going to do about it? We've got to have some form of better way of paying for the cost of catastrophic illness. It is a pity to have people utilize their last resources in a desperate effort to take care of their serious illness. Not necessarily terminal illness, but catastrophic illness. So we surely have got to look at that. We've got to look at infant and maternal care in medicine. And we ought to be looking far down the road to what will inevitably be coming a form of national health insurance. Now it's going to come. Mr. Nixon, the former president, presented us with the program. The hospitals have got a program. The American Medical Association has a program. Senator Long, chairman of the Finance Committee, and Mr. Ribicoff have a program. Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Mills have a program. There are all kinds of programs. The point is that no longer is there a sizable body of people opposed to health insurance as there was 25 years ago. Now the question is, what kind of health insurance are we going to have? That's where you come in. And this is why we need your testimony. This is why we need you to visit with your congressional delegation. And this is why we need to hear from you in as many ways as possible. Now, health insurance today, if you can call it that, covers only 37 cents of each consumer dollar spent on medical care in this country. Now, that's not adequate. The remainder must come directly out of the individual's pocket or income. For some people, this means making choices that they should not be forced to make. For a young mother, she has to make a choice whether to buy her child some new clothes, new shoes, or a checkup with a pediatrician. For a middle-aged father, to use the money set aside for his son's education, or to have surgery to prevent a worsening heart condition or some other disability. And for the very poor, there may be no choices at all. So adequate health care simply cannot be allowed to continue on a basis of cash and carry, limited to the availability of those who can pay the price. Good health care, I believe, is the basic right of every citizen. For this reason, I have supported for better than 25 years a program of comprehensive national health insurance. I'm willing to look at its features, but I think that people have to be covered in some form of national health insurance. More and more of my colleagues in Congress have come to this same conclusion. And just as surely as I'm standing before you in the next 2 years, something is going to happen in this field. There isn't any way out. If you're opposed to it, you better start reconciling yourself to it and get used to it, because it's going to happen. The only question is, how will it happen? What will its timing be? How far will we proceed in one step? Are we prepared to take it on? I think there are a number of questions that have to be answered. Now, I urge you, therefore, to get into it and help us out. I hope that the basic features of the health plan will be the result of your counsel and advice, or groups like yours. It is in the interest of the doctors, as well as the patients, that there be an economical, highly professional, well-run health system in America. And I believe that whatever plan is adopted must conform to at least three principles. First, that every American must be treated equally in having access to quality health care. Second, that comprehensive health care services must be readily available and at reasonable prices. And third, that government has a direct responsibility in seeing to it that these services will be provided and that these cost objectives will be met. That's where the government comes in. How do you pay for it? Not how you treat the patient, but how do you pay for it? Equally important to these basic principles of health care are the basic guarantees of free choice, guarantees that are an integral part of the American tradition. Medical judgment must be the sole responsibility of the medical profession. Doctors and patients must have the freedom to choose how and where to give or receive treatment. And local communities should determine their own health policy with the aid and assistance of their state and federal government. Basic rights of health care, coupled with basic guarantees of free choice, are the twin pillars to support an acceptable health insurance program. No one can predict today the exact details of that plan or the one that will be finally enacted. But one thing is certain. We will have a national health insurance program that goes well beyond anything that your government has done in the health field in the past. And we'll have it soon. With this Congress, unless my judgment is totally at fault, we will have it. Now, I leave you with the challenge that faces the nation today, to create a health system that meets the need and the right of every American for high quality health care, a system which not only removes financial barriers to needed care, but one which also creates basic reforms in the healthcare system to increase its productivity without impairment of its quality. It's a challenge born of progress and hope, not despair and defeat. It is a challenge bold enough for a nation soon to celebrate its 200th birthday, and big enough to require every citizen's cooperation and full creativity. And I wouldn't be talking to you like this tonight, and wouldn't be here if I didn't believe that you had something to offer. And you're specialists, and we need your guidance. And I know that in looking to some of you here, there will be differences of view. But I ask you now to, through your association, through your academy, through your organization, to make your voice heard. Not to make it heard to say no, trying to stop the inevitable, but trying to make it heard in terms of shaping our health care system and our means of financing that system in a way that will protect what I said, the freedom of choice, the basic principles of the right of a person to choose his or her doctor, and the right of a doctor to have the responsibility for the kind of medical care. And if we do that, I think we can get along very well. Thank you very much.